I've talked to a few of you today, and I think the consensus is that many of you, like myself, are busy. We lead a busy life. We're busy. I once had a boss when I worked in Pasadena at the college. And he would not be bashful at all about taking 10 or 15 minutes to tell me how busy he was. And I remember, and he was busy. I mean, he had a lot to do that day. He had a lot to do that night. He had a lot to do the next day. So he was legitimately busy, but as he would tell me how busy he was, I would be thinking, you know, if he would use this time that he's complaining about being busy and do something on his list, then perhaps he wouldn't be as busy as he complains to be. Of course, I really liked him. He was a good boss to me in that period of my life. But it became a little annoying when he would tell other people throughout the day, as I was working with him and for him, and I would hear the same story over and over and over again, how busy he was. Just think how much, if you add all those together, how much he could have accomplished. The world we live in is a busy place. And the world keeps us busy. So busy that society almost seems designed to keep us too busy to even have a relationship with God. I think the God of this world has something to do with that. The world encroaches on us. It puts pressure on us. Well, we have to make a living, right? We have to save for retirement. Nowadays, we have to work hard and save to pay for the Affordable Health Care Act. Now, God did not intend for society to be that way. He did not intend our lives to be a rat race. And one of the worst things that society does is steal our time. It's as if the world is doing everything in its power to absorb every last moment of our time, to keep us busy all of the time, to give us no rest any of the time, to be sure something is affecting our five senses all the time. I remember growing up in Los Angeles as a kid. Los Angeles was a big media center. Hollywood was there. A lot of the television shows were filmed there. CBS Television City was there. You know, other than New York City, I don't know if there was a larger area that had a media center like Southern California did. But as a kid, we had 7 channels on our television. That was it. 7 channels. Channel 2 was CBS. Channel 4 was NBC. Channel 5 was independent. Channel 7 was ABC. And then 9, 11, and 13 were all independents. That was it. And you'd hear people saying, oh, there's nothing on TV. Nowadays, I have DirecTV. I've got hundreds of channels to choose from. I could watch the golf channel all day long. I love golf, but I don't have time to watch the golf channel all day long. There's the National Geographic channel. There's the military channel, the history channel. All these have programs that are educational, interesting. I would love to have the time to watch some of those. There's the travel channel, the Discovery channel, the NASA channel, C-SPAN, the Comedy Channel, Fox News Network, ESPN. Oh, I love sports. I don't dare start watching that, though. Too busy. The Biography Channel. I've seen a few programs on the Biography Channel from of people I knew, or, you know, famous people earlier in my life that I'd forgotten about, and just fascinating programs on catching up on their lives. Court TV. You know, I just don't have time to watch all the television I would love to watch. Now, Bob back there tells me he's too busy to even watch TV at all. I believe it. I had a friend, and Bob confirmed it, that one time retired, and then after a few months, I talked to him, and he said, you know, I'm busier now that I'm retired than... Thank you. I'm busier now that I'm retired than I was before when I had a career. It's good that the rocks are with me and you guys don't have them. You know, that's... You know, they have television shows now about big families, you know, the Duggar family that's got 21 kids or something, you know, I actually got up in the middle of the night once because I couldn't sleep, and I would turn on the TV and I was flipping through the channels, and there was the Duggar family, and the name of the episode was Big Family Going to Big Sandy. And it was them going on a trip to Big Sandy, Texas for a convention at our old property there. I don't know if any of you saw that, but there they were in the old the buildings and the dorms, and they were camping in the piney woods, and you know, it was amazing. There's television shows about flipping houses and buying properties and looking for properties to buy, and buying storage units without knowing what's inside, and you know, the stories just go on and on and on. Families that have more than one wives, and you know, just amazing. This thing, none of those were available when I was a young boy watching my seven channels. Remember before we had personal computers to work for us, to save us time and to give us more free time? That didn't work out very well. Now we can easily eat up big chunks of time sitting in front of our computers. Facebook, Skype, phones now, cell phones. You know, people don't even talk on cell phones anymore. They're taking pictures and sending them to people. They're emailing, they're texting, Twittering, hashtagging. Man has never been more overstimulated as we are today. There's radio, there's satellite radio, there's movies to watch, there's DVDs to rent. Reading material, both on electronic and also in hard copy. Man has never been so overstimulated as we are today. The world completely occupies our lives and keeps us busy. Is there anything that we can do to keep society from totally running our lives and keeping us from God? Well, there is. It is the spiritual exercise called meditation. To do direct thinking. To focus on a topic during quiet time. The problem is, in this busy world, we have difficulty taking the time to do that. Well, let's look and see what the Bible says about meditation. And see how God intends us to steal back time from this world to maintain a relationship with Him. The first reference to meditation in the Bible is found in Genesis 24. If you'll turn with me to Genesis 24, We will read verse 63. Genesis 24. I have a new Bible. Bought it a couple weeks ago. This is my second message out of it. So it's a little stiff to try to find pages, but why I bought it was it says ultra thin, and it's a thin, it's ultra thin. And we're going to the feast in Lake Harmony this year, and I'm going to travel on the airplane. I thought this would be a good Bible. It also says large print. I need large print to be able to read and to see. I just haven't found where the large print is in this yet, but anyway, my other Bible had really good large print, but it was really thick too, which isn't good for traveling. Genesis 24, verse 63. And Isaac went out to meditate in the field in the evening. That's all we're going to read. The verse continues where he's out there and he sees some camels coming. But this is what I want to focus on, the first part of it. And Isaac went out to meditate in the field in the evening. What can we learn from this short passage? Well, number one, he went out into the field. He left his tent or his home, whatever he was living in. He left the hustle and bustle of what was going on in his home, whether there were servants or family members or whatever was going on. He left all that and went out into the field to withdraw from the world, to get away from the things that would demand his time and that would distract him from what he was wanting to think about. Number two, the second point, walking. He went for a walk. Walking is good for meditation. To take a solo walk in a quiet area. Here, we don't really have forests or woods to take a hike in or take a walk in to meditate in. But I know at the feast, many years we've gone to Colorado to the feast, and there was totally different than here in Arizona. There's the forest, there's usually a little river or stream that down in the valley, and there's a hiking trail usually, and maybe even some benches. And I would love to grab my cup of coffee early in the morning and go out there and sit down by the stream, watch the water go by. All alone, just me and God and my cup of coffee. And I told that story last week. And then my wife said, you know, those were bad memories because I was in the condo getting the kids ready, making breakfast, you know, ironing the clothes, putting them in the bathtub. And I look out the window, there you were sitting on a bench with your cup of coffee. Well, that lesson was learned too late, I guess. Okay. But anyway, we love going into another area. Now, here we can go for a walk in the desert, maybe not in the heat of the summer, but going for a walk and talking with God. Maybe along a golf course. Hopefully when they're not playing golf, but you don't want to get hit, but or at a park. Or along a running stream somewhere. All are conducive to being alone, talking and walking with God. Let's turn to Joshua chapter 1. Joshua chapter 1. We'll start reading in verse 1. I asked my little friend at the beginning, when I first walked in, if he knew who the other person was that didn't have a mother, and he said, Joshua. He knew it right away. So much for my preparation. But it says, after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, it came to pass that the Lord spoke to Joshua, the son of Nun. That's where that comes from, son of Nun. Moses' assistant, saying, "Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore arise, go over this Jordan, you and all this people, to the land which I am giving them, the children of Israel." Drop down to verse 8. It says, "And this book of the law," referring to the Pentateuch that Moses wrote the majority of, "and this book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate in it day and night, that you may observe to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have good success." So God said that if you take the time to think day and night about my law, it will make you prosperous. Now, how does that happen? How does that work? Well, if our thoughts and our actions are in concert with God's law, prospering will be a natural result. After all, we won't be making mistakes and then having to serve the consequences of those mistakes. Also notice that meditation is something that happens more than once a day. He's instructed here to meditate day and night. Psalms 1, a familiar psalm we've all read and sung. Psalms 1, verse 1. "Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the paths of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night." So David meditated on God's law. Let's continue reading. Verse 3. "He shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water that bring forth its fruit in its season, whose leaf also shall not wither, and whatever he does shall prosper." So again, another reference to if you meditate on God's law, if you follow God's law, you will prosper. Turn over a page to chapter 5. Verse 1. Here David writes, "Give ear to my words, O Lord. Consider my meditation. Give heed to the voice of my cry, my King, my God, for to you I will pray. My voice you shall hear in the morning, O Lord. In the morning I will direct it to you, and I will look up." We have a psalm that we sing from these words. But it says here, "Consider my meditation." Now, meditation is not entirely a private affair. We should invite God, like David here, to participate, to observe, to listen to our meditation. Now, there's no such biblical rule that says that we need to have 1 hour of Bible study, and it can only be Bible study, 1 hour of prayer, 1 hour of fasting, 1 hour of meditation. Come on, the 1 hour of fasting, I made that up. I'm good at that though. 1 hour of prayer, 1 hour of Bible study, 1 hour of meditation. You know, there are times when combining those disciplines is very appropriate. Let's take Bible study, for instance. If we were, say, reading in Matthew, and we come across that short passage about the transfiguration, you can read through that. It's just a few verses long. And then you can just keep on reading if you want. And you might get something out of that. But what if you stopped after that, and you considered it? You meditated on it. Wow. Well, I wonder what that looked like when Jesus turned and revealed his glory. I wonder what that looked like. I wonder why he only chose those three disciples to go with him. Was he saying something like they were going to be the leadership in the future, or maybe they had distinguished themselves? Or, I mean, why did he pick those three? I wonder what the look on Peter's face was when he saw that. And you're considering, you're meditating, you're thinking about it. Why did Peter say, oh, can we build three tabernacles for these guys now? You know, why did he say that? And what would be the reaction of the other two when he said that? Consider. Meditate. During Bible study. Same thing can be during prayer. You can be praying to God, and certainly some prayers you don't want to interrupt, heartfelt prayers, but there are certain prayers when you're discussing an issue, a problem, where you might want to break off into meditating about it, considering what is happening, and are there any biblical examples that apply to what you're going through? Meditating. Certainly appropriate. Psalms 19, verse 14. The last verse of Psalms 19. Again, David here writes, let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my strength and my redeemer. Again, invite God into the meditating process, into your thoughts. You know, we can't hide our thoughts from God anyway. We might as well include him. Psalm 63. Psalm 63, verse 6. Again, David writes, when I remember you on my bed, I meditate on you in the night watches. How many of you have found yourself lying in bed at night and not able to sleep? I mean, I think that's affected all of us from time to time. And although our first priority is to try to get some sleep, because sleep is very important, this is also a good time for meditation. It is quiet. You are quiet. It's precious time. It's an opportunity to think about God, to think about his law, to think about his plan. It's a time to meditate on personal problems that you've had during the day, how you're going to solve them the next day, situations that you might find yourselves, dilemmas. You know, what are the solutions? Are there any biblical examples of men and women who faced the same or similar challenges? Did they leave a good example in the Bible, one that you can follow? Or did they leave a poor example that you'd want to avoid? Psalms 119. Verse 148. My eyes are awake through the night watches, that I may meditate on your word. Some versions say that I may meditate on your promises. Now, what are the promises of God? Have you ever meditated on those? That would be a good Bible study, personal Bible study for you. Look up the promises of God and then meditate on those promises. You know, one of the most well-known promises is written here in Genesis 15. If you turn back to Genesis 15, here God was talking to Abram, and he made Abram a promise. Genesis 15, verse 1, after these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield, your exceedingly great reward. But Abram said, Lord my God, what will you give me, seeing I go childless, and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus? There was a young man that was in charge of his personal things. His name was Eliezer. He was actually born in his home years earlier. And the way it looked, he said, this is the only heir I'm going to have. This guy, it's not even my son. Verse 3, then Abram said, look, you've given me no offspring. Indeed, one born in my house is my heir. Referring to Eliezer again. Can you imagine talking to God like that? Abram didn't seem to have a problem speaking up. Verse 4, and behold, the word of the Lord came to him and said, this one, referring again to Eliezer, this one shall not be your heir, but one who shall come from your own body shall be your heir. And then he brought him outside and said, now look toward the heaven. This was at night. He said, look toward the heaven and count the stars, if you are able to number them. He kind of challenged him. Go ahead, try to count them. And he said to him, so shall your descendants be. You know, it wasn't until years later that God made good on the promise of a son. And do you think that during those years that he was still childless, after hearing this promise, do you think that sometimes at night Abram would not sit outside his tent flap and look up and was reminded of that promise and looked at all those stars in the heavens, looked at the Milky Way? I think maybe he took a little section of the sky and tried to count some of those stars just to see how many there might be. In 1997, there was a comet that came through called the Hale-Bopp comet. I don't know if you remember the Hale-Bopp comet. Probably the largest comet that I ever remember seeing. There's a little story about the Hale-Bopp comet I'd like to share with you. There was a lady in the church in Phoenix who was working with a man who was an amateur astronomer. And he belonged to an astronomers club, an astronomy club. And they would meet out west of Phoenix on the other side of the White Tank Mountains out there where there were no lights. And they always got together, especially when the moon was dark or just a crescent, because you could see a lot better when there was no moon. And the lady in the church arranged for us. I had expressed my interest in astronomy, and I had a little telescope, and we were looking for activities for our teen group to do, and we had about a dozen teens at the time in Phoenix, and she arranged for us to go to one of their meetings, to go out there on the other side of the White Tank Mountains and be able to look in his telescope, and it was a very educational experience. So we drove out there. We had to go out west on Bell Road, past the mountains, and then that road turned south and head towards Buckeye. And there was nothing out there at the time. Now there's some housing developments, and there's probably a lot more light out there now. So I don't know where this club meets now, but probably not there. So we got out there, and we met this man. His name was Jim Stevens. Jim Stevens, like I say, was an amateur astronomer, but he was very serious at it. So serious that he built his own telescope. He ground his own lenses, and he built this telescope. It was about that long and about that big around, and he had a wood structure around it, and it was very interesting. I mean, it didn't look like a store-bought telescope, but it was very functional. And the thing that caught our eye on it was there was a little piece of metal riveted onto the wood, and it was an engraved piece of silver, I guess, that said, this is the telescope that discovered the Hale-Bopp comet and it gave the date that it happened. So there's a story about this. You notice it's not called the Jim Stevens Comet. Amateur astronomers, or even professionals, I guess, they like to go out and look for comets. They like to look for things in the night sky that aren't normally there. And if it is a comet, of course, the ultimate payoff on it, it gets named after you. Well, Jim Stevens had this telescope, and he also has a book, and many astronomers have it. It's a book that shows page after page after page of the night sky and all the points of light in the night sky. So they will take their telescope and they will punch into the computer keypad on the telescope a certain coordinate in the night sky, and they coordinate it with the page that they're looking at. And so they'll look into the eyepiece and then they'll compare to the page, and they'll look back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. They'll count all the points of light, make sure there's nothing extra on there. And when they're done, they're satisfied, they go to the next page, punch in the telescope, moves a little bit, they do it again. Now, I can think of a lot more exciting things to do, but this is what they do. Well, one night, Jim Stevens is doing this. He's out there with the rest of the club, and they're out there, and he's studiously going page after page looking for something that's not in the book. He gets a little tired. It's cold. Usually cold nights are even better to look at the night sky at, because it's even more clear. So he decided to go over and get a cup of hot chocolate. And he asked his friend that accompanied him that night, his name was Thomas Bopp, he said, "Would you like a turn at it?" And he said, "Sure." Thomas Bopp was not nearly as serious an astronomer than Jim Stevens was, but he had an interest in it, and he knew what to do. So Thomas Bopp punches in the coordinates, the telescope moves, he turns the page, the same one, he looks back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and he sees something in the telescope that's not on the page. And he checks it, and he double checks it, and he triple checks it, and he said, "Jim, I think I've got something here. Can you come verify this?" He comes over, and he looks, and sure enough, there's a little point of light in the telescope that's not on the page. Well, this was either before cell phones or before cell phone coverage out there. I don't know which, but cell phones were not as prevalent then, I know that. They didn't have any way of communicating, so they packed everything up in the car, telescope, the chairs, the table, the hot chocolate. They drive down that road and around Bell Road to the first Circle K where there was a payphone, and then they called this number, which is kind of a clearinghouse for astronomers. If they see something, that's the number they're supposed to call. And so this Thomas Bopp called it in. Little did they know that in Texas, that same night, that same time, there was a guy by the name of Alan Hale, not the Alan Hale that was the skipper on Gilligan's Island, not that one. Oh, you remember him, don't you, the skipper? Okay. A different Alan Hale. But Alan Hale in Texas was doing the same thing and was on the same page and saw the same point of light. I mean, what are the odds? But he did, and he ran into his house because he was in his backyard when he did this, and he called the same number. That clearinghouse sent the information to the professionals, and they verified it, and sure enough, the bottom line is Alan Hale and Thomas Bopp were awarded with the naming, with the name, their name on that comet, Hale-Bopp Comet. I kind of feel sorry for Jim Stevens, whose telescope it was, who, I mean, it's just bad timing, but that's the way it goes sometimes. Well, that night, Jim Stevens tells us that story. Thomas Bopp was there. He told us his side of the story. There was a newspaper writer there to interview Thomas Bopp. And so it was a very educational, very wonderful evening. So I tell that story to tell you this story. That night, they showed us all kinds of things from that telescope in the night sky. We saw the Hale-Bopp comet. We saw the edge of the crescent moon, a very small moon that night, a very sliver of a moon, which was fascinating to look at. We saw nebulae. We saw twin stars. We saw planets. We saw constellations. We saw galaxies. I mean, this telescope could see way out there. Later, after he showed us a variety of things, he asked each of us to pick something in the night sky that we wanted to look at. Someone wanted to look at the North Star. Someone wanted to look at Orion's Belt. And someone wanted to look at the stars in the Big Dipper. And so all the kids got to go, and then I was looking, and I was trying to think, what is it that I will want to look at? And you could see the Milky Way going through, and above the Milky Way, there was an area in the sky that was empty. It was blank. There was nothing there. So, you know, I like to be different. So when it was my turn, I pointed out to Jim Stevens what I wanted to look at. I said, that empty spot there. You know, he just smiled. And he cranked the telescope right to that spot, and he says, go ahead and look. So I looked in the eyepiece, and there were thousands of stars. I mean, you can't see them from the naked eye. It looked empty. But you look through the telescope, and many of them may have been galaxies far, far away. Let's turn to Psalms 19. We've been there once. Let's return there. Psalms 19, verse 1. There used to be a song in our hymnal, a song I liked. Verse 1, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. And that night we had quite an education with especially those teens to see that firmament, to see the glory of God in the heavens. Day unto day utter speech, and night into night reveals knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line is gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them he has set a tabernacle for the sun, which is like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, and rejoices like a strong man to run a race. I have a hot tub in my backyard. I've had one for a number of years, and I prefer taking a spa or taking the hot tub with my wife, and we can talk and converse, but sometimes I have to go alone. And when I do, I like to take advantage of leaning back and looking at the stars. If there are no clouds and there you can see the stars, I can sit there and meditate on God's creation. We can usually see the Big Dipper and then know where the North Star is. We can see Orion's Belt usually, and occasionally certain times of year certain planets come through, Mars or Saturn even. I've seen, even with my binoculars, you can see the rings of Saturn, Jupiter. But the lesson, though, or the interesting thing is, as I'm sitting in my hot tub looking at that, or if you're sitting in your backyard and you look up, you go camping in the woods where there's really a good view out of the city, and you can see the Milky Way, those are the same stars, the same handiwork of God that David was looking at and wrote about. Those are the same stars that Abram looked at and considered that promise. Psalm 77, verse 11. Psalm 77, verse 11. I will remember the works of the Lord. Surely I will remember your wonders of old, and I will meditate on all your work and talk of your deeds. Remember the miracles and the mighty deeds that the children of Israel witnessed and saw and lived through. See, from the time that God first sent Moses to talk to Pharaoh to the day that he spoke to them on Mount Sinai, the 10 plagues, each one progressively devastating the most powerful and, at that time, scientifically advanced nation in the world. The pillar of a, or the cloud that they followed, and then the pillar of fire at night. The crossing of the Red Sea, where the sea actually separated and they walked through with the Egyptian army trailing them. And then to see that sea crush that army as they tried to follow them through there. The quail that God sent them to eat. The manna that showed up 6 out of 7 mornings. The bitter water that was made sweet. The water that came from the rock. The battle with the Amalekites, their first big battle, where Moses was told to hold his staff over his head. And as they fought, and as long as he kept his staff over his head, the Israelites would win. They were winning. Then his arms got tired and grew weary, and he started lowering down, and then the tide would turn in the battle. Then finally, God showing his power to them on Mount Sinai, actually hearing God's voice along with the thunders and the lightnings and the earthquakes, the smoke. Have you ever considered each of those? Have you ever meditated on what it must have been like to witness that or to experience those things? To see the awesome power of God? Return to Psalms 119, verse 15. Psalms 119, verse 15. I will meditate on your precepts. Verse 23. Princesses or princes also sit and speak against me, but your servant meditates on your statutes. Your testimonies also are my delight and my counselors. Verse 48. My hands also will I lift up to your commandments, which I love, and I will meditate on your statutes. 78. Let the proud be ashamed, for they treated me wrongfully with falsehood, but I will meditate on your precepts. 97. Oh, how I love your law. It is my meditation all the day. Yes, David meditated on God's law, on his precepts. Let's turn back to 19 again, Psalms 19. I know this is the third time we've been there. But there's more to read there. Psalms 19, pick it up in verse 7. The law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The statutes of the Lord are right, rejoicing in the heart. The commandments of the Lord are pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. More to be desired are they than gold, yes, than much fine gold, sweeter also than honey and the honeycomb. Moreover, by them your servant is warned, and in keeping them there is great reward. Yes, David meditated on God's law, verse 7, on the law of the Lord and the testimony of the Lord. Verse 8, on the statutes of the Lord and on the commandment of the Lord. 9, the fear of the Lord, the judgments of the Lord. Those are the things David meditated about. And like David, we should meditate on God's laws and on the principles of God's of godly living. To be quiet, to get out of the world for a short time, to sit or to walk, to ponder about God's law, about our lives. How can God's law be a solution to a problem? Why did God say what he said in his word? Ask questions and work your way through them. And in a moment of quietness, the Holy Spirit that is in us and with us, it will help us understand. You know, in John 16, verse 13, Jesus said that when the Spirit of truth comes, referring to the Holy Spirit, it will bring to our memory all manner of truth. So when we go through the process of meditation, giving ourselves quiet time to think on these things and to think these things through, it gives the Holy Spirit an opportunity to help us to understand, to come to the proper conclusions and to the solutions for our questions. 1 Timothy chapter 4. Verse 14. Here Paul writes to Timothy. He says, he warns him, he says, do not neglect the gift that is in you, which was given to you by prophecy with the laying on of hands of the eldership. Meditate on these things. Give yourself entirely to them so that your progress may be evident to all. This is Paul's instruction to Timothy, but we can learn something from it as well. We need to spend time meditating on the gifts that God has given us. And God has given each of us certain distinctive gifts. Not all of us have the same gifts, and certainly none of us have all the gifts. But God would not have called us if he didn't see something that he could use in us. So start with your talents and the blessings that have come into your life. Then consider, how can I serve God? How can I serve God's people? How can I serve God's church? What has he given to me, and what should I do with what he's given to me? It's one of the prime purposes of meditation. So we have seen that meditation is one of the main spiritual disciplines that we should practice. We've also read that David and Joshua and Isaac, they all set as examples of meditation. And thirdly, we have seen many things we can meditate on. So in closing, I'd like you to turn to Matthew 13. Matthew 13, we'll start reading in verse 24. We'll read about the parable of the tares. Matthew 13, verse 24. Here Jesus is giving a parable. Another parable he put forth to them, saying, "The kingdom of heaven is like a man who sowed good seed in his field. But while men slept, his enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat, and then went away. And when the grain had sprouted and produced a crop, then the tares also appeared. So the servants of the owner came and said to him, 'Sir, did you not sow good seed in your field? How then does it have tares?' And he said to them, 'Well, an enemy has done this.' The servant said to him, 'Do you want us to go out and gather them up?' He said, 'No, lest while you gather up the tares, you also uproot the wheat with them. Let them both grow until the harvest. And at the time of the harvest, I will say to the reapers, first gather together the tares, bind them in bundles and burn them, but put the wheat into my barn.'" Interesting story. Thankfully, starting in verse 36, Jesus explains what all this means. Verse 36, "And Jesus sent the multitude away and went into the house, and his disciples came to him and said, 'Explain to us the parable of the tares in the field.' And he answered and said to them, 'Well, he who sows the good seed is the Son of Man. The field is the world. And the good seeds are the sons of the kingdom, but the tares are the sons of the wicked one. The enemy who sowed them is the devil. And the harvest is the end of the age, and the reapers are the angels. Therefore, as the tares are gathered and burned in fire, so it will be at the end of the age. And the Son of Man will send out his angels, and they will gather out his kingdom, out of his kingdom, all things that offend and those who practice lawlessness, and will cast them into the furnace of fire, and there will be wailing and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. He who has ears to hear, let him hear." I guess my point is that God has sowed us into the world. That's where we find ourselves. And there are terrors all around us. And it doesn't matter if you live in Hollywood, California, Las Vegas, Nevada, New York City, Tucson, Arizona, or even on a remote ranch in central Montana somewhere. It doesn't matter, because the world, the terrors, are all around you. And it can get to you through the internet, through television, the radio, telephone, newspapers, snail mail. The pressures to make a living, paying the bills. First John chapter 2, verse 15 says, God says, "Do not love the world. Do not love this world." One of the reasons is because it's a thief. It steals our time. Steals our time from our relationship with God. Mark chapter 4. A similar parable, but different. Mark chapter 4, starting in verse 1. This is the parable of the sower. Mark 4, verse 1, "And again he began to teach by the sea, and there were a great multitude gathered to him, so that he got into a boat and sat in it on the sea. And the whole multitude was on the land facing the sea. And he taught them many things by parable and said to them in his teachings, verse 3, listen, behold, a sower went out to sow. And it happened as he sowed that some seeds fell by the wayside. And the birds of the air came and devoured it. And some fell on stony ground where it did not have much earth. And immediately it sprang up because it had no depth of earth. But when the sun was up, it was scorched. And because it had no root, it withered away. 7, and some seeds fell among the thorns, and the thorns grew up and choked it, and it yielded no crop. 8, but other seeds fell on good ground, and yielded a crop that sprang up and increased and produced, some 30-fold, some 60, and some 100-fold. And he said to them, he who has an ear, let him hear. Well, he explains, again, starting in verse 13, the parable of the sower. But there's just one verse I want to emphasize. That's verse 7. Here's where it said, and some seeds fell among thorns, and the thorns grew up and choked it, and it yielded no crop. He explains that in verse 18. He says, now these are the ones sown among the thorns. They are the ones who hear the word. Well, we've all heard the word. Every one of us have heard the word. Then he gives this warning. And the cares of this world, the deceitfulness of riches, the desires for other things entering in, choke the word, and it becomes unfruitful. Yes, the cares of this world, of this society, can smother us to the point where there's no time for God. The cares of this world can choke us if we allow it. Our spiritual strategy should include some quiet time every day. Escape from the rat race and give some time and attention to our spiritual life. Meditation is a spiritual discipline that is the perfect foil to steal time back from this world and to devote that time to our relationship with God.